Adam Kramer, national lead college football writer for Bleacher Report, kegs and eggs on the tweet machine, joins us. Adam, how are you, sir?
Doing well. How about you guys?
Doing good. Thanks for joining us.
There's that old adage, no such thing as bad publicity. And right now, both Alabama and the University of Michigan are in the news because there's of the little feud going on, the war of words, so to speak, between the coaches. Is it a bad look for either school, or is this just you're in the news, all eyes are on you, and when you're as good as you are at Michigan and at Alabama, that can never be a bad thing?
Look, given the news cycle for the sport, I think that Saban and Harbaugh exchanging these jabs is welcomed in a lot of ways. And when you think about, you know, what they're arguing over, you know, satellite camps, which I think has quite frankly been in a sport that really overrates its controversies in a lot of instances. Like, this is probably the most overrated of these things. Like, when you think of what they're discussing, this is not going to shift planets here, and yet you have, I'd say, two of the three most polarizing figures in the sport going at it. I think it's great. I think, to me, if this is the first of many of these things, I'm all for it because, again, the hope is that eventually they'll meet up on the field. And if you could have those sour expressions just sort of staring across each other throughout the entire game, I'm all for it. So, no, I think it's awesome. I think this is the kind of fun off-season storylines you hope for when you get this kind of stuff. And quite honestly, it's sort of natural now that Jim Harbaugh's going to produce these things because – he has no issues taking on pretty much anybody at this point. I think we learned that when he's going after Saban and really not thinking twice about it.
What's the school's response going to be? Do they like the way that their, I guess, most influential or biggest face for their entire university is representing him in this way?
I think right now, sure. But this is sort of a calm before the storm because Michigan won last year and they did well, and this is still a honeymoon phase. And it's fine. And look, you look at some of the bills they're racking up for these camps and their trip to IMG, a lot of money being tossed around. It's quite clear that Harbaugh has basically been given, no leash. And so he's going to do what he wants to do. The publicity that's come with it, well, it brought in a really good recruiting class. Everything is looking up at Michigan. And yet what the concern I think you'd have as a Michigan fan is, you know, Harbaugh has the natural ability to wear out his welcome, and the messaging is going to look a little different if they fall short of expectations. To me, the expectations of this team this year is the playoff. I think we've expedited those, but now when you look at the frontline talent, they should be very good. So does that start to change? This sport, I think, at the college level versus the NFL is more conducive for turnover, and maybe Harbaugh won't wear his guys out, but will that messaging eventually wear out? The answer, we'll have to figure it out. But right now, I think they kind of enjoy it. They're sort of taking on this role of being this kind of like that heel, that wrestler that turns heel, you know, in the WWE. That's fine. We'll see what happens when they hit the field, though. I think undoubtedly that'll change.
How do young players react to things like this? I mean, ultimately, these guys, every comment they make is, I guess, potentially influential in recruiting. If you're a parent of a high school kid or your high school kid at this point, what's the reaction?
I think it probably depends on your back. I would imagine that there are a few responses to Jim Harbaugh. I would imagine there are some that are just completely, you know, this is off-putting to them, and they don't want to deal with it because, although in some ways it's like that Rex Ryan theory of taking the pressure off your team, you're actually putting the pressure on your team. If you don't win now, I think the failure will be amplified. And yet there are some that look at that Harbaugh, quite honestly, they look beyond all the conversation. They look at what he's been able to do, the talent that he's been able to bring, and all the things that come with it, and say, yeah, we'll just deal with it. This is kind of who he is, and we'll put up with it for the sake of the football front. So I would imagine the reaction internally and in recruiting, you hit the full spectrum of things, but there's no question that it has raised awareness for the school. It has probably had a small impact on recruiting. I think some of that can be overblown, quite honestly. sure, it impacts it. And I would imagine satellite camps dealing with all these kids, taking photos with kids like he was doing today at their first satellite camp. Sure, that has an impact. But ultimately, I think you have to sell what you're selling, which is the program in the school. And much of this, I think, you're going to sift through if you're a parent or a kid and say, is this a good fit for us?
Talk about fits and determining where to play. We've seen the quick response to Baylor and what's happened with their program. They've had seven of their recruits ask out of their national letters of intent. How much is this Baylor decision and what happened at Baylor going to change the sport and how administrators and coaches themselves, I guess, conduct themselves?
I want to say a lot. And I want to say that this is a moment that is going to change the dynamics of the sport and the things that matter, which is the way people treat other people and the way coaches value wins versus the health and overall stability of program. Basically, it's are we going to win at all costs anymore? I'm skeptical of that. Honestly, when the Penn State situation happened, and I hate bringing that up because it seems like I'm comparing the two, but when you start to learn of these inner workings of these horrific happenings, you know, that's a wake-up call of epic proportions. And obviously it was different then, but still, you look at that and you say, how can anything like that ever happen again? Well, this is obviously different, but still horrific in nature. I wrote about this last week. Before Art Briles was fired, before we had the findings of fact, which still leaves a lot of holes to be addressed and, you know, accountability and whatnot, but if you're a Power 5 program or any program and you're not meeting behind the scenes right now and reassessing what you're doing, then what are you doing? Because if this isn't an eye-opener to you, and if you can't see how quickly everything can come apart, and it's going to come apart, this is only the beginning, recruiting, everything else, we'll see what the NCAA's involvement is. If this doesn't impact everyone else's procedures to stop and look at themselves in the mirror and say, are we operating the way we're supposed to operate? Then again, I have no hope that the sport, that anything will, because this is an eye-opener unlike any we've seen in a while.
At Baylor, we're talking about, like you mentioned, some pretty nasty stuff, right? Really unpleasant and even sinister things that not only affect the football team, but the culture at the university and the society surrounding whatever community that a university is in. And that's all really serious. And then there's the situation with Laramie Tunsil and draft day and Ole Miss and the fallout there. And the Baylor situation, quite frankly, overshadowed the self-sanctioning and things like that from Ole Miss. But this is, it's one of those, the oldest story in the book when it comes to college football. Like, oh yeah, big time recruit gets the $100 handshakes or coach pays the bills for him or whatever. And we know this goes on and we know that the NCAA tries to sniff out every instance and tries to punish every single one severely. But what's going to happen with Ole Miss as this process vets itself out?
Yeah, the timing of that release, I know they kind of picked the date. If we're being honest, if you're a PR at Ole Miss, I would imagine you're taking this week off because that feels like a non-story. In a normal college football offseason, in a normal, you know, quiet nature of events, that is the story, and certainly it's something we're talking about. I look at this. There's some pretty serious, like, you know, allegations, you know, being discussed. If you're an Ole Miss fan, it's probably a little bit more than you thought they might have. If you remember around National Signing Day, Ole Miss very, very brilliantly leaked that none of these allegations involved Hugh Freeze and this was no big deal. Well, they involved Hugh Freeze. I mean, again, there's a lot here, but Ole Miss has taken them head on. They've done some of the self-sanctioning, which we've seen in the past. Miami did that and had a great deal of success, basically getting off after the fact. So ultimately, I don't think, you know, I think the people that were looking for these dramatic allegations of hundreds of thousands of dollars changing hands and buying these teams, I think they probably read that and were thoroughly disappointed, if that makes sense. So Ole Miss fans probably read it and say, it's a little bit more than I thought. And everyone else is, oh, man, you know, everyone else wants these dramatic, massive football scandals when it comes to paying for players. There really wasn't that. When you look at, you know, hotel rooms, and sleeping on coaches' floor. I mean, it just wasn't there. So it'll be interesting to see how the NCAA reacts. Be interesting to see what else comes from the Tunsil situation. But to me, honestly, now that they've already started punishing, that's a really good sign. That cooperation goes a long way in the NCAA's eyes. So I'm curious to see where we go, but I wouldn't expect major significant punishment, and yet trying to handicap what the NCAA will do at this point is a difficult thing in itself.
Adam, let's talk a little bit of actual football at this point. We've talked to quite a few people, and we always ask if there's a national title, if they see a national title contender possibly coming out of the Pac-12, and the consensus has been no at this point. Are you in the same boat that this is another season where the Pac-12 just eats itself alive? Excuse me.
On the surface, yes. Look, it's so difficult to tell year to year, and I am intrigued by Stanford and USC, UCLA obviously with Josh Rosen. I'm not sure what Oregon will be. I think Washington State could surprise. I think Utah's still going to be very good. Either Arizona team could break out, and obviously Washington's got quite a bit of buzz. So there's a lot of really good teams, and yet you don't have necessarily that team in there that's going to be, you know, when we're doing all these playoff predictions, you go through, without a doubt, the Pac-12, the team that's going to be left out more times than anybody else. Doesn't mean anything, but there is a lot of turnover in the conference when you look at overall talent, and I think it's probably going to make for the most entertaining conference that we have out there right now, simply because there's a lot of these games where home field's going to carry such a significance. I don't think we know what's going to happen. So it's not absent of talent by any means. In fact, last year, before the season began, I was talking about the Pac-12 sort of supplanting the SEC and becoming the conference that we're going to be talking about. Well, it sort of bloodied itself up, which is something that could happen to the SEC this year as well. Ultimately, you just need a few swing games to go your way to make the playoffs. I mean, that's the thing about it. Right now, would I project it out? Sure. But if Stanford gets hot and a late missed field goal goes their way, I mean, that's the difference in all of this, is having those late moments in most situations, you know, break a team's way. That's all you need, is one team to separate itself from the pack, and there's enough here to tell you that team could emerge. It's just hard to pick out which team that will be right now.
Christian McCaffrey had a stellar season, a Heisman-worthy season last year at Stanford. What's he going to have to do? Are his numbers going to have to be better? Is he going to have to do more next year to get the same treatment and maybe actually win the trophy because of the expectation and the bar that he set so high?
It's ridiculous what he was able to do when you go back and you look at his season that he had, and specifically the way he closed, because that's what, when you're looking for a Heisman, that's what we're talking about. But actually, no, I don't think so, because I think at this point he's done everything possible to raise his profile. I think truly even going into the bowl game against Iowa, which I think helped lifted a lot of that as well. When you look at how ridiculous he was, that was yet another way for him to kind of improve his candidacy for this year. So, no, I think from even being in the Heisman race, you know, with what he did against USC, which was, you know, we know how Heisman voters operate. I mean, as sick as it is, there were a lot of votes that were already sent in at that point, or people had made up their mind at that point. It's a strange award. But to me, no, I don't think he has to reproduce those numbers, which were unbelievable. I think if he's good, and more importantly, I think if Stanford's good, Stanford makes the playoff. I mean, that's a big part of this. Stanford makes playoff, and he has a season, say, 300 rushing yards less yards per carry. I think he could up his touchdown total, certainly something that hurt him. I think he's got a very good chance to be in there. Now, he doesn't have to try and add on to it. Realistically, I think that's going to be very hard to do. He's good enough where he can do it. As long as Stanford wins a lot of games, he's going to be in the mix until the very end.
Outside of McCaffrey, who's the best player in the Pac-12?
God. I mean, you know, we're looking ahead. I'm floored by Josh Rosen's potential. Like, I would imagine you guys are as well. When you watch him throw a football, it comes out differently. You know what I mean? It has that. There are very few people, when you see it, even like a 12-yard out, where he can turn like a 12-yard out into football art. Like, that's what I think about when I look at it. By the end of the season, I think he's going to be the guy. Now, it's been, you know, you talk about strange and peculiar off-season storylines. I know Jim Mora is not thrilled with him with wearing making a statement against Donald Trump earlier in the year, and then UCLA signs this enormous athletic contract. Josh Rosen kind of makes a jab at, you know, amateurism.
Mm-hmm.
No one, by the way, the majority of the people who are commenting on this didn't necessarily have a problem with it. It was just Jim Mora saying, you know, bringing in the name like Johnny Manziel. I don't think that's the case at all. I think Josh Rosen's a smart, particular, determined kid who just kind of knows what he sees and calls it how he sees it. If he takes the next step in his development, I mean, the potential there, and they've got some really good pieces around him, is off the charts. I don't think you're going to see a Christian Hackenberg-like setback for him. There's too many good players around him. Offensively, if he puts it all together, I mean, we're going to be talking about him and Deshaun Watson as the best quarterbacks in football at the end of the year.
We talked about the Pac-12 conference as being a conference of QBs, conference of coaches. Is there any particular position group we should be keeping an eye on in the conference this year, you think, that really separates them from maybe the rest of college football?
I think in general, you know, you have to start at running back, I think, because to me, you know, I mentioned Josh Rosen as the next best player. Royce Freeman, you know, is right there too. And those talents are so superior in terms, you know, historically, when you look at it, I think they're both just fabulous. I think the question is, you know, is it so good elsewhere that it just matches up? That position to me in general, though, and I'm kind of turning this into a national spin, something I'm writing about right now. When you look at the running back position across the country, I mean, you lose a Heisman winner. Some may argue that Christian McCaffrey would have lost it, and yet the position is so loaded. If running backs are your thing, this is the year you have to watch. I mean, Royce Freeman, to me, is a perfect example, one of the best players in the country that seems to be overlooked nationally because you have guys like Leonard Fournette and Christian McCaffrey and Dalvin Cook, you know, and others who've been talking about it. I thought, Devontae Booker was a great example of that last year as well, positioned in such good shape that you rarely got to a guy that was so good in so many areas. So to me, just having those two backs, even though you lose some really good players at that position, Booker and Perkins and others, I mean, having those two backs, those are your two posters, the kids you put on posters for your conference. Then you see what else you get out of that position elsewhere.
Adam, before we let you go, it's June 1st. Who's the best team in college football as it stands right now?
Oh, I have gone back and forth on this a handful of times. I'll probably give you the default, boring, chalky answer of Alabama, and I don't really feel great about that because I think Oklahoma, Clemson, and Florida State makes a fascinating case. And yet, I think Alabama's team construction this year will be a little bit different when you look at the pass rushers that they have at linebacker. Led the country in sacks last year after being sort of middle of the pack in that statistic for so long. The way they changed identities on defense, I think, is fascinating. Offensively, Calvin Ridley is going to be one of the best playmakers in the country. Bo Scarborough at running back, I've seen this guy up close, is actually bigger and faster than Derrick Henry. I mean, it's truly remarkable what they have waiting. And the question is at quarterback. Can Lane Kiffin, for the third year in a row, develop an unproven quarterback? And we're going to find that out. And it's probably unfair to assume that they will, and yet the track record says there's so much talent there that they'll probably be able to assemble something close to a team that's going to be on the verge of making the playoff.
Last thing before I let you go, Adam.
Oh, geez, my apologies.
Utah is kind of the dark horse candidate in some people's minds and in some publications to be a Pac-12 contender. I've seen even maybe the playoff sleeper, but we saw what playoff hype did for Utah last year before that USC game. What's your idea of this Utah football team's ceiling for the 2016 season?
I think the schedule sets up pretty well for starters. I mean, you look at the road games, and I think that's a really big part of this. You get a Cal team that's going to look a little bit different, still should be pretty good, but obviously without their quarterback is going to be different. You go to UCLA, which will be tough, but again, we don't know how tough that will be. And to have, I think it's such a huge home field advantage to get a USC there, an Arizona there, which can be a tricky road spot, to get Oregon there, which, again, is a difficult road game. I think the schedule actually sets up well for them. I think, the difficult thing to kind of regurgitate last year is, you know, this was a team that, to me, was on the verge of being that playoff crasher. The problem is that every other week mentality, which may ultimately do in the conference in terms of playoffs, I think they're a perfect example of that. I think offensively, even though they lose Booker, should be very explosive. I think defensively, we've seen, you know, what they can produce from that defensive line yearly. I think they're going to be balanced. They're going to be very good. I think it's just a question of, you know, I in terms of the ceiling, can they string together enough games in the middle of that schedule to give this playoff another, you know, another go like they did last year for so long? I'm not sure if they're there, but it wouldn't shock me at all to be talking about, you know, 9-10 wins somewhere in that threshold. They've got the schedule, I think, talent to do that.